This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The Book of Ruth by Jane Hamilton, narrated by Angela Jane Rogers. This work is copyrighted 1988 by Jane Hamilton. This recording is copyrighted 1997 by Recorded Books Incorporated. Honey Creek is a simple little town way up north in Illinois, right on the Wisconsin border. Poor and backward, if you blink, you might miss it. And Ruth is a simple young girl, some say stupid even, the loser in a small-town family that doesn't have much going for it in the first place. And now, The Book of Ruth.
Chapter 1. What it begins with, I know finally, is the kernel of meanness in people's hearts. I don't know exactly how or why it gets inside us. That's one of the mysteries I haven't solved yet. I always tried to close my eyes and believe that angels, invisible in their gossamer dresses, were keeping their loving vigil. I learned slowly that if you don't look at the world with perfect vision, you're bound to get yourself cooked. Even though I may still be looking through the dark glass, even though I haven't finished learning the lessons, I'm the only one who tells the story from beginning to end. It can't be up to Ruby, because he's been spirited away and born again. Neither love nor prayer can bring him back. May can talk herself blue in the face and no one will hear. By rights, this belongs to Justy, because he inherits the earth for a short time. But he doesn't quite count yet. He'll remember the taste of pecan balls, exactly how the powdery mash got stuck on the roof of his mouth, the color black, maybe, and the color and shape of Ruby's teeth. They were rotten with sweets. I tell myself that it should be simple to see through to the past, now that I'm set loose, now that I can invent my own words, but nothing much has come my way without a price. I'm not counting on a free ride. I know the only way to begin to understand is to steal underneath May's skin and look at the world from behind her small eyes. I shudder when I think about the inside of Ruby's head. But I know I have to journey there, too, if I'm going to make some sense of what's happened. Sometimes Aunt Sid shocks me into seeing myself in a new light. She'll speak to me, looking straight into my eyes, and it's as if she's talking to an adult. And then I realize she is, that I am, in fact, grown up. The bones in these legs don't get any longer. She tells me that there has been a grave error, which is actually how I felt for a considerable length of time, as if I'm a series of sums that doesn't come out right. She says she doesn't understand how my clear intelligence went unrecognized, but I haven't explained to her yet the confines of my mother tongue. We were the products of our limited vocabulary. We had no words for savory odors, or the colors of the winter sky, or the unexpected compulsion to sing. The language I had to speak, to be understood, is not the language of poetry or clear thinking. I only let on once to May that I had acquired other words for private use. In the Bible, it starts with the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the water, but I don't buy those ideas. You couldn't pay me to take my story back that far. Everyone's probably heard of Honey Creek, where I lived with Ruby and May. There isn't anything fancy about the location, except the iron gate around the church and the pigeons with their purple breasts. Mr. Avendroth, the oldest person in town, spends his time walking through farmers' fields, picking up corn and stealing apples, and he shares his loot with the pigeons. Honey Creek is way up in the very north of Illinois. If you lean over the Abendroth's back fence, your torso is in Wisconsin. You will miss the town if you drive through listening to your favorite song on the radio, or telling a story about your neighbor. The two blocks of white clapboard houses with black trim will look like nothing more than a cloudy morning. Only Mrs. Crawford's house is blue, like the color eyeshadow my friend Daisy wears. And she has a red barn in the back. She had her place painted blue after her husband Bub died, and everyone figured she'd gone crazy with grief. Then for Christmas, she put lights all over the trees in her yard, colored lights, which flashed on and off. Then everyone watched to see if she would come out one day wearing hot pants and white boots, setting off to marry someone 40 years younger. Every Memorial Day, neighbors get together and put on a parade. A parade without a marching band or a fire truck. There are three horses, five old men dressed in uniforms as if they were all set to free the poor slaves, and a hay wagon with the Kraut Queen, if we're lucky. Last year the Queen had ringworm on her face and didn't show. Since there isn't an audience to speak of, because everyone in town is in the parade, it snakes back along the same road after a while so the front can view the rear marching by. One year I wanted to be a nurse with a real Red Cross outfit to wear in the parade, but May said stop wishing for the impossible. She cut a paper plate in half and pinned it in my hair, drew a cross on her white apron, and set me walking. You're supposed to slow down to 35 when you're going through Honey Creek, but most people speed by. There simply are no outskirts to prepare the driver. At the intersection, that's County Road J, you'll see the post office and the grocery store, which doesn't have anything useful except beer and milk, toothpaste and potato chips. Across the road from the mart is our church, our white church. One of the church committees put up a steeple a few years ago to accommodate the new bell, which plays songs three times a day. It cracks me up going by there when it chimes Rock of Ages, as if the church has a big old mouth and it's singing to itself. No one ever stops to listen except the Labrador Retriever. He's tied up outside of the post office because he belongs to the postmistress Laverna. He howls to all the songs like he's overflowing with devotion. He sits on his haunches and lets out a long, sad moan. In the block beyond the church, there are four more white houses. All of them have heavy plastic over the windows, meant for winter, which blow and rattle in the summer storms. The pickup trucks, parked outside in every yard, come in handy for deer hunting and cutting wood, plus driving places. If you look in the garages, you'll see they're filled with rusty farm machines, milk cans, large rusted wagon wheels with broken spokes from the ancestors. People in Honey Creek like to keep junk in the family. You never know if a huge chest of bent nails might not come in handy sometime. You can't be too careful. I think folks hold on to metal scraps and furniture because the world is an enormous place, far and wide. But they have never experienced much of it, and they're afraid. They want an anchor so there's no danger of drifting away into outer space or down under the ground. Strange places they aren't too familiar with. The river comes next. Our town is named after it. It isn't deep or long, but it has water and bloodsuckers and fish. If you cross over the bridge, you come to the edge of Honey Creek proper. You see the factory. Everyone in town is proud to have industry, That's what they call it. It's a cinder block building, and it doesn't have windows. Most of the letters fell off the sign that says what it is. Even with industry, half the town doesn't work in Honey Creek. The other half is practically dead. People go to Stillwater to teach school, sell clothes, work in the factory that makes paper napkins. Honey Creek used to have a mill by the river, but it doesn't function at the present time. It used to grind victuals for humans to eat. I wonder if I'd been born just 5 miles the other side of town, would I have met Daisy? Would I have known Ruby? Would my story have happened to me or a complete stranger? I'd like to know exactly how much I'm to blame. Was it my character that triggered the events, or chance, that I woke up and found myself in Honey Creek with a big old dog howling to Rock of Ages? The ancient saying goes, none are so blind as they who won't see. And I'm banking on there being truth in it. Otis Buttle's fields come right up to the parking lot of the factory. There isn't a space between. There isn't a minute to switch gears. Get used to the idea. After the factory, it's all farms. Muddy fields and the smell of someone hauling manure. And the sight of a rusted-out combine sitting in the lane as dumb and still as a cow. Of course, the cemetery is along the highway, too. I love walking there in October because the maple trees line the road and they turn crimson and orange and gold, a paper-thin gold. My Aunt Sid says that the trees must be doing a dress rehearsal for their own death, a phrase that has always made me wonder if we rehearse our death and if we know when we're rehearsing it. There are a lot of dead people in the cemetery, but what you see are the same 10 last names over and over on the gravestones. I used to be certain that everyone in the whole world was related. About a half mile out of town is where we live, on a farm. We live in a wooden house, but I wouldn't exactly call it white. It hasn't been painted since May got married the second time, which would take me a long time to calculate, because I'm not, as anyone within 20 miles could tell you, a wizard in math. There are pink granite stone steps up to the porch, similar to palace steps. We go around back to the kitchen door, where the trash and tin cans could trip and kill you if you weren't paying strict attention. May plants purple and red petunias in the planters each year. That's when the washed-out gray house looks drab compared to the flowers. When I was small, my favorite time of day came at the sight of Wendell Kate driving the cows past our farm into Honey Creek to his barn. It's a gift he gave me. I have the memory of 20 cows stumbling down the road, so not one car can get by. And there's Wendell on his big old blue bicycle with the high handlebars. He's a red-headed bachelor. His pants always look like they might slip down from his waist, since he doesn't have a rear end to speak of. His crotch is about at his knees. He spent his time in church glancing down the pew and winking at the ladies. I loved the sight of Wendell on his bike, his red hair so flaming his head looked like a great torch, and the 20 cows not wanting to walk. You'd hear the squeeze horn he had on his handlebars all the way into Honey Creek. He got killed by a bull a few years ago. He didn't like to use that artificial stuff for breeding. He bled to death. Sometimes I feel like I'm 100 years old and I can see clear around the world. And then other times, I think how I'm nothing. I don't have one thing on my mind except pictures of bachelors riding their bicycles. I haven't even been out of Illinois. I only spit into Wisconsin. In high school, when I was in all the dumb classes, we learned about the evil man Hitler over in Germany. And even though Hitler seems as distant to me as the Romans and their crumbling walls, I feel like I know him, just a little. I have to feel kind of sorry for him, for what he had to do. There was something in him that he couldn't help, that made him more terrible than anyone before or after him. I said those words out loud in my class to Miss Dakin, my teacher. She had a nose like a pelican's mouth, this big old hook nose that looked like it could catch fish. I said that maybe history books didn't tell about Hitler's good points, and she stepped all over me with her steel-toed eyes. She was so tired of teaching dumb students. I wanted to say that it was the same with the Bible, that the serpent was doomed before he hatched, that something so low and sneaky and slippery wouldn't, by its very nature, be taken for good. It seems as if nobody could really be all bad, although everyone has the meanness in them. Sometimes people choose one person in a crowd to pick at. It makes them feel better to see how there's one entirely rotten person they can blame everything on. When I grew up, I heard about the wars we were having with other people on television. We watched some of the battles. I knew we were safe from the machine gun fire in Honey Creek, where there hadn't ever been wars, if you don't count the Indians. There was only the one Mexican family who lived in the trailer home, and even though they had 10 children, they were too disorganized to cause trouble outside of their own family. Without putting words to it, I recognized the beauty of war. I realized that it was entirely in keeping with ordinary human nature. It wasn't until I was 10 that I realized our family must be the ones with the wrung-out hearts and that other people's faces shone with a sadness for us. I was 10 when my father climbed into the Ford one morning in the dark. I heard his black boots crunch on the gravel. He was too scared to start the engine, so he rolled down the driveway with his foot on the clutch. "Goodbye to Illinois," he probably said to himself, because he had lived up here near Honey Creek all his life. I threw off my blankets and ran downstairs and down the road in my nightgown, shouting at him to come back. We learned later that he drove to Texas, to his brother's grapefruit ranch. He lived in a tin shed next to his brother's house and spent his days picking grapefruit the size of my own head. I thought about him at night, reading his paperback books by the light of a smoking kerosene lamp. I couldn't stand the thought of him being happier there, but I had enough sense to know it was true. Soon after he left, we sat in church on Sunday, and I could see how sorry people felt for me. I could hear their whisperings about the latest tragedy. I could tell by their faces and their eyes that we were new and strange. They came past us in church, filing out, and I knew suddenly they were the kind of people who would pet me like I was an animal that didn't have a single chance to survive. The young Mr. Snodgrass bent down to me while May was in the ladies' room, and he told me that I was going to be a big, strong, pretty girl one of these days, and I appreciated his words. But I could tell from the scowl on his wife's face that he was lying. I had heard Aunt Sid telling May she looked pinched once, and I wanted to ask Mr. Snodgrass, right then and there, if I was pinched too. When I got home, I took out the mirror to examine my new and strange looks. My eyes are squinched together. They're small and gray, and they don't open all the way wide. My mouth isn't too much better off. It's tight like a closed drawstring laundry bag. There's nothing special about my nose. It's small and it sits on my face, like someone set it down and forgot to come back for it. My hair, my best feature, is nothing more than tight brown curls stuck to my head like I'd taken glue to them. But at least there's room for improvement. When Daisy does my hair over, it looks shiny and fluffy, like a souffle cooked up to perfection. May is very much the same, except she's older and uglier and heavier than I am, and she has a wart by her nose. She has wrinkles, too, like she went and slept face down on an oven rack. Sometimes I see her standing by the door in plain view. She's so clear and radiant, she hurts my eyes. After Elmer disappeared into the wild blue yonder, I always liked the sound of the wild blue yonder. It was somewhere I wanted to go. After he left, May reminded us that Daddy rolled away because we made him. When we asked her, "Is he coming back?" she said, "You made him go with all that fighting you do." I used to listen to May like she was about 100 miles away, and the only thing I could hear was her thin voice trailing off on the other side of a mountain. Sometimes, when I played, I pretended I was actually a regular person. I sat out in the yard with the hens, calling each one by their first full names. I gave them confirmation names like Catholic girls had, such as Prudence Grace and Mary Ellen Maria. They loved me for bringing their mashed corn. I kept wondering why I wasn't a hen or a bug. Even back then, I wondered how I got where I was. Did I choose to be May's baby girl? Or was I like pieces of dust floating around in the wind and then landing any which way? I said to May, "How come I'm your baby girl?" She cocked her head like she was asking herself if I was ready to hear the news. Then she sat me down on her bed and asked me if I recall how the ram had to do his business in the fall. I said, "Sure." I had only seen it about 1,000,000 times. The ram curls his upper lip and snorts around. He can't help it. I knew how it was with animals, but I didn't think the process translated over to people. She said it did, that we had pretty much the same equipment as animals. I stared at the floor. I was trying to imagine. I had never seen men, say in the grocery store, simply walking up to ladies with their lips quivering and then climbing on top of them. I couldn't remember seeing that kind of behavior, so I asked, "But how does it happen with people?" "It'll happen when someone pushes you down on the bed and lifts up your skirt," May said, laughing. When she saw my scared eyes, she said, "I'm teasing you, Angel Face. I'm only teasing." She said almost under her breath, as she left the room, that it was something crazy adults did for fun, and I'd understand years from now. I couldn't believe what she was saying. I came after her into the hall. I said, "You mean people do it for entertainment?" She snickered with her back to me. She tried to act serious as she turned around, but she said, "Yeah, she guessed it was all just for fun." She didn't look happy at all, maybe because she didn't have one person who would let her get anywhere near them. Or maybe because what she told me was an enormous fabrication meant to hide something sad. You can tell the ewes don't like it when the ram curls his lip and rides around with his hooves sunk into their wool. They tolerate it with the patience of saints, but it isn't the greatest experience for them. As soon as he's off, they act like nothing happened and wander back to the feeder. The idea slayed me. Here I was on planet Earth because May had 1 minute of fun. I didn't mind so much the thought of my being a piece of dust. I liked the idea of floating around and then changing into a baby, in the dark, in secret. But I got gloomy when I thought maybe it was my choice that put me in May's belly. I knew she was hiding the truth, and really, I had a little something to do with the scheme. It meant I made a dumb mistake. I closed my eyes, wishing I had the memory of what all my parts were before they became me. If I hadn't been born, I suspect nothing would have happened to us. If I was very smart, I could have been Mrs. Crawford's girl, Diane, and lived in a blue house, the color of eyeshadow. When I got gloomy, when I was 10 years old, I sat on the ground with the hens pecking near my feet, and I screwed up my face to try and remember the good occasions in my life. Just one thought in a day to carry me beyond my dark feelings. My favorite memory, the one I went back to the most, happened the year July was so hot you sweated standing still. I was 7. Matt, my brother, and I, and May and Elmer were drinking black cows in the kitchen after supper. Elmer, scooping up refills, missed my glass, and this splat of ice cream landed on my head. It is crystal clear. We are a family, laughing our heads off, and I'm laughing too, because the ice cream feels cold dripping down my hot skin, and I'm making faces, twisting up my tongue to get the drops. Everyone's howling at me, and I'm cracking up because I know I'm funny. I have my eyes crossed. May doesn't try to wipe off my head. The flesh on her bare arms is shaking, and she has tears coming down her face. She can't breathe. Elmer stands behind me with his hands on my shoulders, patting me. He has a deep laugh with spaces between, like he has to remind himself every few seconds what's so funny. And the best part is Matt. He reaches out to touch my arm. Suddenly, I'm a celebrity. I wished then, while it was happening, that we could have stayed there at that kitchen table for about 5 centuries. I could have stood it that long. I wanted to preserve that scene, just as fossils do, keeping rare animals so still in stone. It took me several years to figure out that on that July night, we were actually experiencing the gladness some people feel every day, not just once in a summer. I saw how it was with other people, because I watched the children in church, running to their mothers after Sunday school. I saw it every Sunday, week after week, year after year. The mothers swept their children off their feet and kissed them on their cheeks, and both mother and child laughed. They didn't need to say words because they had this gladness inside. Just the same as if for a few minutes they all had a splat of ice cream dripping down into their mouths. And it's the hottest day on earth. Chapter 2. I only had to annoy Matt because he was smart. Delayed is how May described me to myself. Matt's a year younger than I am, but he learned to talk first. He always told me what to do in whole sentences, pointing his finger at me. I couldn't seem to make the words to say jump in the lake. I couldn't say words, but I noticed that they were all over the place, in your ears, in front of your eyes. I watched Cheerios march across the cereal box. I loved how ease looked, so squat and happy. I couldn't say thoughts or insults, but I wrote down letters on the walls. I saw the word bear, and I wrote bear all over my room. I printed silo in green crayon on my white dresser. Elmer practically made an exclamation when he came into my room one morning, and there's Silo on my dresser. As far as he knew, I didn't have the marbles to say dog. He laughed at me under his breath. I could see him knowing he should scold me, possibly with the shoehorn, but deciding against it. He went and got a wet washcloth to scrub the word off. He spoke one of his longer sentences. He said, "Don't tell anyone our secret." I nodded my head with all the sobriety I could muster, although I wanted to scream to the world, "We have a secret!" Since Matt talked like an expert, he told me what I had to be when we played house. I was always the man in a black top hat. We found the hat squashed flat on the bottom of the trunk in May's bedroom. I was the husband each time, and Matt got to be the bride. He wore a veil on his head and May's old white high heels. He stumbled over them, fell and bruised his knees. I didn't offer him pity, although we were recently married. I could be the doctor making babies come, and the father, but Matt had to be the lady. When he served me tea in our plastic cups, he bawled me out in a high voice. He told me I should hurry up and get back to my chores at the barn. He said there was mud and other materials I won't mention on my boots. He reminded me that I was tracking it all over the clean carpet, and for punishment, I would have to vacuum. Matt had the words, but my gift was the strong muscles in my arms to put him flat on his face, and when I socked him, I had joy in my heart, surging fresh into my vessels and knocking in the core, because I could see blood flowing out of his nose. There was a space where time stopped dead, and I listened free to his terrible hurt sounds. It lasted until May made the room come alive with her body in it, yelling the pure strain of noise only she and rabbits who are dying by the knife are capable of. She was like sergeants on TV shows, frowning and whistling and pointing. She said she didn't think my brain functioned. She shook her head and wondered why I was retarded. I didn't pay attention to her when she discussed my intelligence. I was waiting to spring on Matt. I was watching for his weak points. The meanness that some people have in great quantities came to me early, because Matt became a prodigy. The minister says all of us have proud hearts, which helped me understand why I had to clench my fist and hit Matt's knowing eyes. When he and I got into school, I couldn't clobber him quite as easily. He grew taller than me in the space of 6 months, so I had to think of other ways to make his body sting. He understood all math. He was perfect at numerals and digits. He knew about numbers you can't even see on paper, and everyone at grade school said he was truly a phenomenon. I mentioned the circus or the zoo as an ideal spot for viewing him, but May suggested, with her hand held high, that I shut my flap. Every teacher discussed Matt's brain in the teacher's lounge. The smoke was always seeping up over the folded screen that obscured the doorway, and you could hear the murmur of the teachers' voices as they ripped the youngsters' personalities into 20 pieces. Arthur Crawford said you would die of emphysema instantly if you even set foot in the lounge. I tripped Matt coming up the road from the school bus, and he cried a piercing cry that was out of proportion to the injury. Every now and then, it struck me that his tears were the same material as any old human being's, even people who didn't have parabola shapes whizzing through their heads. But I didn't stop capturing bees in paper cups and dumping them inside his sheets. He knew the bites he got were my fault. He never mentioned the stings to me. He went straight to May to tell. Naturally, she petted him. She always wanted to stroke his silky hair that covered up where his quick thoughts were made. Sometimes, when I had to be in my room for the salt I put in Matt's milk, the tacks in his brownie, I cried, because the real punishment was Matt never noticing I'm alive. Like the numbers he's always looking at breathe the air, and I don't. When I think about little Matt, I hardly see a person there. In my mind, he's a rising river filled with leeches. I have one small dry square to stand on. And finally, I can barely keep my nose above water. I have to work exceptionally hard to conjure up each one of the features on his face. He had fat cheeks and thin blonde hair and brown eyes the shape of pennies. His perfect teeth grew in like they were choir members filing sternly into their pews. He had stomach aches and head colds half the time. May loved nursing him. She'd come out of his room, softly closing the door behind her. Elmer read stacks of books about the Civil War, the Second World War, and the wars of ancient times. In rare moments, if he didn't know you were crouching in bales of hay watching him do the chores, he mumbled poetry he had learned in high school. Ennobling words about cohorts gleaming in purple and gold, and steeds with flaring nostrils, and the angel of death. Not the stuff of his average argument with May. He loved historical novels about lands so far away they didn't seem like they belonged in the world. After supper, he came to his chair in the living room, with his round, shiny, bald head sticking up, and he sat breathing loudly while he read, until the snoring started. Sometimes he stayed there all night, or until May shook him back into this time zone. She yelled at him for falling asleep before he built her a pie safe or mowed the lawn. She probably wasn't crazy about sharing the corn husk mattress with him, but she got hurt feelings when she realized he'd rather spend the night in an armchair than brush his back against the bristly curlers she put in her hair to make her curls even tighter and stiffer. I don't have too many clear memories of Elmer. He stayed out of the way. He didn't come into the house except for supper, to get yelled at, to read his books, and sleep. I could tell he wished he was something desirable, like a cow. When I picture him, I see a looming shadow, and then a bald, shining head. After he left us, when I sat in my room missing his shape and the gleam of his head, and while I felt particularly angry at him, it occurred to me that if they were going to name a song after him, it would be called Silent Night. That's a perfect title for him. There are just a few memories that come through in one entire piece. Events with Elmer and me, together. The one day in March, when the lamb was born the year I turned 8. I used to lie on the floor out in the barn in a heap of straw to see if the lambs liked me. I told them stories about my life. They climbed on top of me and poked around to see if they could find my milk supply. I let them paw me and gnaw on my fingers. There was a ewe rolling her eyes around one day and curling up her lips, looking back to her rear end with great agitation, as if she wanted an explanation from her hindquarters. I had seen a lamb born twice before, once when Elmer had to help it come. I understood the mystery taking place under my nose. I sat waiting, and pretty soon, with a grunt from the mother, a little white head poked out of her. I loved seeing the quiet face. That lamb didn't even know it was being born. I waited for an hour. All I could see was the head, stuck, and its pink tongue hanging out of the side of its mouth. Something wasn't right because the mother pawed at the ground and then lay down, dragging her rump right through the dirt. The infant head was getting all muddy. The tiny pink nostrils were going to get clogged with dirt. So I went over, finally, and said, "Easy, easy," like Elmer did, tenderly, and I wiped off the nose. It was similar to the experience that Alice had in Wonderland. The lamb's front hooves were sticking straight out under the head, and I could hear a small voice whispering, "Pull me." I swear I heard the voice 3 times. I knew that lamb was having problems getting born. I knew I didn't have a decade to decide whether to dance or to hobble. So I pulled the legs as hard as I could with both my hands, and the mother gave a terrible groan, and then splat! Out came the whole wet lamb body, yellow like an egg yolk. It was all slimy and sneezing. It shook its head as if it had a bug in its long wet ear. The mother naturally began to lick it and grunt and snack on the afterbirth. She was glad to have the whole works out. I couldn't believe the strength in my hands, what they did. I smelled the yellow color on my fingers. It smelled so raw and new. I had to quick close my eyes and wonder. I kept thinking how the mother didn't put up a fight. She let the pain consume her without the faintest understanding. She didn't have any idea about her life from 1 minute to the next. You could see how much having the baby killed her, the way her eyeballs rolled back into her head. Maybe she was watching the inside of her brain and seeing miles of green alfalfa and acres of trough filled with golden corn. She was awfully brave to merely scream and then lie still while a puny girl yanked at her lamb. I had to spit to admire all that courage in the mother. When Elmer appeared, I whispered, "I helped it come." He said, "Well." He grinned at me for lack of words and then bent down to examine the newborn. When he stood up, he said, "Aren't you a good little farmer?" I hugged my own ribs all the way to the house while Elmer rested his hand on top of my head. In the spring, when I heard all the frogs down in the marsh singing as if they had urgent thoughts they wanted to speak of, I sat at the table eating, and I had to blurt out how I wanted to know a frog and know what they talked about down there in the murky water. They made such a racket, and they were invisible, I said. All those frogs singing night and day without stopping. What are they saying? May snapped at me. "You just eat, young lady. You get frogs out of your head." I learned to stay quiet at meals because I usually said sentences of astounding dumbness. May looked at me like I was a stranger. Elmer didn't say anything, perhaps to avoid getting the cold stare that suggests you're a lunatic. And Matt ate delicately and then went straight to his room, leaving piles of food on his plate. May would have loved to feed him with tweezers. She made a sport of seeing he got enough nourishment. She stood over him, watching him put the smallest bit of tuna casserole into his mouth, and she waited until he screwed up his face. She scrutinized his plate afterwards to see if she could figure out exactly how many peas he had eaten. If I couldn't help mentioning that it made me sad to see the geese flying south in the fall, how there was something inside of me that felt like cracking, May said, "God for Daniel, ain't you gloomy? You make me want to dig a hole and stick my nose right down in it." I kept my observations swirling around in my head. Occasionally, I spoke with the chickens, and in the spring and summer, I planted and tended and talked with carrots and lettuce. They were my special vegetables. I was in charge of them. I spent whole afternoons in the dirt, making my patch of ground flawless. I even cleared the worms away before I found out that all the tunnels they make give air and probably other molecules I don't know about yet to the plants. I started out in the hole in school because of my impression that I was a miracle of stupidity and because I was afraid of my own teacher. Her name was Mrs. Ida Homer, and she wore cushiony shoes like nurses, only hers were red, and you could smell stale cigarettes and coffee on her breath. She had thick, flabby ears that looked like nice, soft pillows decorated with little tiny white hairs. I longed to rest my head on them. Her eyes were gold, and I was sure from the first moment I saw her that they were hollow inside. I tried to hold her hand once when we were filing down the hall, but she shook me off. I never tried again. I knew even then that she wasn't very fond of children. Her ears were her best feature. Plus, her husband's name was Beau. I never saw him, but I couldn't help picturing him as an oversized red frilly ribbon you could tack on a birthday present. Mrs. Ida Homer made me stand in the wastebasket because I wrote on my desk and poked my neighbor, and because I did not follow directions. Instead of drawing pictures, I put words all over the sheets of paper. I love the shape of letters in a word like shampoo. I got into trouble for coloring outside of the lines when we were drawing turkeys for Thanksgiving, and I forgot to put hands on May, the time we drew our families. Her hands were just the things I did not want to think about. Mrs. Ida Homer said I didn't do my coloring right. She said I had to stay in for recess to get the colors inside the lines of the turkey. I waited for the words she was going to say when I did something wrong. One of these days, she was going to tell me that I had to stand in the wastebasket for the next 8 grades. I suspected that all the teachers in the whole school were exactly like Mrs. Ida Homer, and I tried to imagine 7 more years, then high school, with ladies who would watch Arthur Crawford stick a clothespin on the back of my arm so it pinched, and then give me the punishment. Matt caught up with me in school by the time I was in 3rd grade. He skipped 2nd. He had absolutely no use for that grade. May wanted him to go directly to college, but the counselor said then he wouldn't fit into society. Matt and I weren't in the same class ever. He didn't have to have Mrs. Ida Homer back in 1st grade. She might have been able to make him feel slightly lacking for a minute or two. He had a math book he did on his own since his brain was at least in junior high. He was leaving his body behind. His head was going to get larger and larger, and his arms would shrink to the size and weight of long deflated party balloons, the black ones. His feet would become webbed to support the weight of his calculations. I imagine the President of the United States asking Matt for advice. My brother wouldn't be able to see over the desk in that oval office they always speak of, and he'd have to pluck out bee stingers from his hands, which I was responsible for, while he recited figures. Matt was destined to come home with gold stars pasted on his papers. I didn't have anything to show because I had dropped my work in the trash before I got on the bus. I couldn't concentrate on one thing except how everyone said I was the ugliest in class. If boys and girls touched me, they thought they were poisoned. Diane Crawford had a special potion in her desk. She said it could cure people if they, by accident, got too close to me. In 2nd grade, I had a dress with blue and yellow violets covering the fabric. I liked it very much at first, especially because it featured a braided yellow straw belt with a blue leather buckle. The instant Missy Baker saw it, she said that the dress used to be her sister's, and that it got in the Goodwill box by mistake. Then she changed her story and told everyone that I stole the dress from her house. She said she knew she had heard someone in the laundry room the week before. Therefore, I told May I despised the dress. I rolled on the floor, kicking, trying to rip it with my bare hands. I sobbed that I wasn't going to wear the dress one more time, even if she smacked me all over my body. May is a saver, like everyone else I know. She fished the dress out of the garbage. She calmly stated that it was in excellent condition, and she laid it out for me to wear again the next day. Every time I wore it, Missy Baker said her sister wanted it back, and she was going to personally come to rip it off of me. I'd have to be in school, sitting at my desk, bare naked. On the playground, a few girls, along with Diane Crawford and Missy Baker, told me they'd be my best friend if I obeyed them. They took me out behind the hedges and said I had to close my eyes and stand still. I could feel hands lifting up my dress and pulling my underpants down. I could feel people squatting on the ground, staring up at the way I was made. They looked while I shut my eyes tight. I was going to have so many best friends. When the bell rang to come in, there wasn't anyone around me. My underpants sat at my ankles. I knew all the girls were swarming around Diane's desk, getting the potion to purify themselves. After third grade, my fame ceased, and no one paid any attention to me, because Elizabeth Remenchik moved in. She not only came from somewhere near Poland and had a club foot, but she was also cross-eyed and had to wear thick glasses. When you looked at her eyes, you felt as if you were looking way down through the ice on a lake and watching two slow fish trying to keep alive through the winter. What I waited for were the letters from May's sister, my Aunt Sid. Sid and May weren't the best of friends because they had always squabbled, and because May never forgot past injuries. There were all sorts of occasions for mistrust, one of the latest being the time the family divided up the spoils from the home farm. May thought Sydney was extra greedy and grabbing more than her share, taking antiques that were valuable and leaving behind the riffraff for May. Never mind that Sid was responsible for shipping Aunt Marion's portion down to North Carolina. Aunt Sid had learned over the years to ignore May, even when May came behind her, nipping at her heels like a yapping dog the size of a peanut. Finally, as the last dresser was loaded into the truck, Sid turned on May, told her in a normal speaking voice that she was a sorry excuse for a sister, and that she had never been reasonable. Sid quickly got in the car before May could scratch her eyes out. Soon after the grab, Sid came over to make amends. May didn't serve cookies like you're supposed to for guests, even though it was clear Sydney came with her arms loaded down with olive branches, not to mention proof. She had photos of Aunt Marion's living room that showed where the valuable antiques were located. May said nothing. She averted her eyes from the saltwater taffy box and the basket full of extra fancy red delicious apples. She mumbled something about requiring charity from no one and left the room. I was alone with Aunt Sid. She took a present from her bag and handed it to me. I didn't care about the gift. I wanted nothing but blonde hair exactly like hers, sweeping back over her head into a long bun held together with tortoiseshell hairpins. She had brown eyes and lips that were a color I never saw on anyone but Aunt Sid. I had to stare at her mouth, at her moist lips continuously. Finally, she showed me the tube of lipstick in her purse. It said Coral on it. She stretched out her hand for me to come closer. I never forgot how her lips parted and she cocked her head and smiled without fear. Although I looked like May, Sid seemed sure I wouldn't tear her nylons with my fingernails or sink my teeth into her thigh. I took her hand and went to her side, without one thought in my head. I couldn't hear what she was saying into my ear because my heart was singing like a frog calling to her partner down in the marsh, singing through layers of mud. I hung on to her skirt until she left. I watched her drive away. I watched her even after her car disappeared into a cloud of dust and exhaust. The present was a music box that was intended for Jules. It played Oh, How Lovely Is the Evening. After Sid was gone, May came back into the living room. Her face was puffy. I knew she never cried, so I figured she must have gotten stung by several hornets. "What's that box?" she asked. "Nothing," I said, trying to hide it under my dress. "Give it here," she said, grabbing it from my arms. She turned it over in her hands, lifted the lid, and heard the song. She bent down and stared at the metal pegs striking the keys for several minutes, completely absorbed by the machinery. "It's mine," I said in a voice hoarse from the frogs chanting in my chest cavity. She laid it on the table without saying a word and went to stare out the window. It seems to me that later in the day, she smacked me out of the blue. She must have felt that she bungled her chance to make peace with her sister, and she was so mad at herself, she came at me with her zinging hand. I learned the lesson about justice fairly early on. If the rulers of the kingdom aren't fair-minded, then there simply isn't any such thing as fairness or just deserts. I'm not going to tell you how many times in the following weeks I set out for DeKalb, where Aunt Sid lived, before my stomach led me back to the hearth fires. I won't tell you about my dreams starring Aunt Sid, who adopts me, and I happen to look exactly like Shirley Temple. In the third grade, I actually started to know Aunt Sid. We were supposed to write to a pen pal. All the girls in my class picked their best friend, who sat across the aisle from them. I didn't understand the logic of writing someone within reach, so I chose Aunt Sid, who lived 40 miles away. We were to write one letter a week to practice our penmanship. We were to ask our parents for stamps if we wanted to write someone beyond the classroom. I took stamps from Elmer's table, where he paid the bills. I could not believe the miracle of the U.S. postal system. Aunt Sid wrote me back each time, and since it was my task to bring the mail up from the box at the road after school, May never knew of our regular communications. At first, Aunt Sid told me about her childhood, and she wondered if it was still the same there in Honey Creek. She guessed it probably was. She said if she remembered hard enough, she would know how it was to be me. She hadn't lived in Honey Creek since she was 18, at which time she figured out what was good for her and made a beeline to the teacher's college in Evanston. If you have talents, you can get away from Honey Creek fairly easily. But if you don't have anything exceptional to show for yourself, you might as well forget it. No questions asked. Once she told me that I shouldn't use gonna in my letters, that the words were actually going to. I instantly wanted to shape up. My teachers had spent plenty of red ink and cross words correcting me, but I didn't see any use trying to please people such as Mrs. Ida Homer. Aunt Sid was different. I longed to understand what was correct. For her eyes alone, I wanted to write everything as precisely as the Queen might, transcribing from her gold-bound grammar rule book. It didn't take a high-voltage brain to figure out the best uses for May's harsh talk, that her tools were particularly well-suited to describing the varieties of barnyard manure. I didn't want to talk the way May talked, but it was everywhere around me. With my hands clamped over my ears, I still kept hearing the F word. Even after third grade, Aunt Sid wrote me once a week. I couldn't understand why she wanted to, but I always wrote her back before the smell of her wore off her heavy beige stationery. I made up stories about how May went to the Sears store in Stillwater and bought me 100 dresses, all in different colors. And girls at school wanted to have clothes just like mine, but their parents couldn't pay for so many dresses. I wrote her about how I wished I could be a bloodroot flower. The jewels that come in the spring at the edge of the woods. They are white and clean, and in the evening they close up tight, as if they're a hand holding something secret in their fist. If you wait too long to find them, All their petals are on the ground, and there's nothing but a naked stem. I told Sid she should call me names such as Diane or Missy. They were such beautiful names. To my surprise, Aunt Sid wrote saying that it was nice to own lots of dresses, but she'd rather have a letter from me than have a new outfit or the sight of a blood root. She said things I knew couldn't possibly be true. What I knew for fact, even then, was that Matt would steal away. I could think only of Matt when I saw a shooting star out of the corner of my eye. Always, when I turned to look, it was gone, and I had to imagine a trail left behind the blaze. Teachers had the habit of calling up to take Matt to special classes, show him off. They took him to Chicago, to a museum where he saw a gray submarine. He told me it shot torpedoes through the water. I was afraid, for as far back as I can think, that Matt, with his smartness, would order the sub to come wipe us off the earth, and what's left would be a pile of chicken feathers on the ground. Chapter 3. I'd like to tell you that May told her story to me, but I can't. Everything I know about her, I learned from first-hand experience and from Aunt Sid. When I picture May, I first have to wonder about the very day she was born. It was the early morning of a dark, rainy March day, according to the legend my Aunt Sid grew up with. There was a flood, and handfuls of dead worms floated around the yard. Perhaps May got the idea that that's what it all was going to be like, so she never noticed the sun shining, unless it was beating down on her and making her unbearably hot. I love when I'm outside, feeling the sun on my skin. The grass and the cats on the porch, and myself, all thirsting after the warmth and finding it, make me know that there's something mighty about our planet and the whole works out there in the universe. May doesn't have curiosity about sunshine, or the very first crocus flowers that come in the spring. Sometimes, when there's still snow on the ground, we see purple petals bursting through the white flakes. They have the urge and the will to see the light. But neither heaven nor earth moves May to thought. She says nature is around just because. Maybe there was a bad omen on her birthday somewhere, and no one paid attention. Like on the worst day of my life, I saw a whole slew of birds on a telephone wire, hanging upside down by their feet. They were murdered by the current. They were still and so black, hanging and hanging. It spooked me, but I didn't think it was a warning. May was the first baby out of eight. The second child, Richard, was born deaf. My guess is after all the others started coming, one after the next, including the boy who couldn't hear and who sat and smiled while everyone pitied him, she turned a little sour on the entire race of man. She fell to the floor, actually hurting herself, and no one ran right to her side to pick her up. Or if she banged her head against the wall, the hired girls said, "Knock it off," even if they noticed the blood. People were too busy to soothe her scraped knees and her sore head. When the third child, Marion, came, May was sent away for 2 months to the great aunt's house in Stillwater. My grandmother, with the deaf boy and a newborn, couldn't handle little May. The two aunts were proper ladies, with dusty velvet couches and rooms with warped floors, and shelves full of china dogs children weren't supposed to touch. May couldn't examine a thing in the house for 2 months because the aunts were forever screeching, "Stop!" They expected her to sit still and never get dirty, and to like to eat stale bread softened by milk and overcooked peas. I can imagine wrinkled old Aunt Margaret hovering over May, explaining where she got the China Afghans, the three of them, with rabbit fur coats, all strung together with a golden chain. Her breath was probably like the smell of goats when they are panting and giving birth. She stood close, smacking her thick lips, exhaling into the air that was meant for May to breathe in. And she laughed at everything May said or did in her nervous, high-pitched laugh. She laughed before May had finished the sentence. Sid says Aunt Margaret had a flat face, like a pug dog, flat and smashed, and eyes that were too small for her drooping sockets. I can picture May, 3 years old, living away from her parents, waiting night after night on her cot in Florence's and Margaret's parlor. After they kissed her with their oily lips and turned out the light, May would have stared at the China mother collie on the top shelf, who she was sure some night might come to life, take her neck in its strong white teeth, and bring her home. When May did come home to the farm, she walked through each room, and nothing looked as she had remembered it. The furniture was in different places, without a doubt, and she hadn't recalled the constant sharp ache in her stomach. She wanted to squeeze the baby's hands while it sucked at her mother. It rolled its eyes around and stuck out its tongue every which way. Everyone said it was beautiful, which made May suspect she didn't know the correct definition of the word. She couldn't stand to watch it feed. She looked at it in a basket with a pink